Testing supplies are getting more and more challenging to come by. And with no testing strategy at the national level, this means that we're competing with other states who have also had to increase and advance their testing and pooling. We're ready to do that, but for needing federal approvals still.
Now, as we've had more time to study, the virus seems to attach to and affect and inflame blood vessels. And so the brain, the lungs, the heart, and the blood vessels themselves can show effects.
We lose somebody in the United States every 80 seconds. And we lose businesses that have been in families for generations. The entire globe is COVID fatigued.
Call 575-646-2212 with your questions. We'll begin right after NPR News on KRWG Public Media. Good afternoon and welcome to Voice of the Public, Friday, August 14th. It's 1:06. This is Casey Counts, and I am joined today by New Mexico Department of Health media manager and social media manager David Morgan. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon.
Welcome back to Voice of the Public. We're glad to have you.
Thank you. Great opportunity to be back.
And we are also joined by the ABC's coordinator with the Epidemiology Response Division, Dr. Selena Torres. Welcome to KRWG.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start, Dr. Torres, by having you tell us a little bit about what the ABC's coordinator does.
Right, so that's actually a isn't related to COVID, so that's what I was doing in the pre-COVID time and eventually we'll go back to. So ABC stands for Active Bacterial Core Surveillance, and New Mexico is one of 10 states in the United States that participates in this program through the Emerging Infections Program through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so basically what we do is we are tasked with doing surveillance or monitoring of invasive bacterial infections in individuals in New Mexico. So this is any kind of, or we have five specific, you know, bacterial infections that we look at for individuals that have an invasive infection, which means that the bacteria has traveled through all, you know, through their bloodstream and in their system, in their circulatory system, and requires them to be hospitalized. So New Mexico provides data that informs the national picture of how these infections, you know, look like in the United States and what prevention measures we can do to stop them from occurring. And so one of the infections people may be familiar with is group A strep. You know, sometimes it is very a benign infection, and sometimes it can be systemic and then cause somebody to be hospitalized. And of course, if people have an immune-compromising condition or already have poor health, then it really becomes a dangerous situation for them. So that's what I do. That's what I did before COVID. Of course, things have changed since then.
And how has your role changed as a result of COVID?
So my position is within the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Bureau. And so we, within that bureau in the Department of Health, we are the section that receives the laboratory results for all COVID tests, positive and negative. Then we are tasked with identifying who is a new case, who is a person that has already tested positive. We create what we call an investigation, and then we assign these out to our case investigators. So these individuals call the case, explain to them, you have tested positive, we need you to go into isolation. They explain what that means, what that looks like, how long that's going to happen. We ensure that individuals have the resources they need. We make sure that they are stable enough to stay home and isolated. If they need, you know, healthcare, we help them get that done safely without exposing other individuals. We ask them questions about their course of illness for a variety of reasons. One is to try to get a better handle on what this illness looks like in New Mexicans. So, you know, there's a lot about this virus and what it does to people that we don't know and don't understand yet. And so being able to collect that information helps us develop better guidance, better, policy, better restrictions or lifting restrictions based on data that is collected. So we ask questions about that. And then one of the really important parts of the investigation is we want to know where an individual may have been and potentially exposed other people so that we can collect their contacts. We reach out to their contacts, let them know that they have been exposed, and then ask them to quarantine so that we can prevent further spread of the virus. So we're kind of the core center, or the hub of where all of these activities begin, and then we branch them out to our different teams to get what we call the COVID response done appropriately with what we believe to be the most effective and appropriate public health response to keep New Mexicans safe and mitigate the spread of this virus as much as we can.
575-646-2212. The number to call if you have a question for Dr. Celina Torres or David Morgan, spokesman for the Department of Health. David, let's talk a little bit here about the Answer the Phone campaign while we're on the topic of what sounds like contact tracing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what we are, of course, encouraging New Mexicans to do is to answer the phone. If we are calling you as part of contact investigating or contact tracing. And there's the difference between contact investigating and contact tracing. Contact investigating is speaking specifically to the person who has tested positive for COVID-19 themselves. Contact tracing are those around that exposed person who may then in turn have been potentially exposed to COVID-19 themselves. The campaign is just really all about being able to bring attention to the fact that we do definitely want and need you to answer the call. In an era where cell phones are dominant, where we all do this. We look at the caller ID and we go, nope. If we don't recognize the number, and we let it go to voicemail. But in our case, if we're calling, you will see on your caller ID New Mexico Department of Health. And if you see that, and whether or not you have been tested for COVID, regardless of how you're feeling, it's definitely a good idea to answer that call to be able to make sure that everything's going to be okay in your world.
We already have a caller holding on the line with a question, but I do want to ask you, David, to address quickly the potential for scammers now who are apparently trying to take advantage of this situation.
Yeah, nothing like a pandemic to bring out the worst in some people. We have been made aware of a couple of different scams. There are, in the northern part of the state, there are fake plastic cards that have both the New Mexico Department of Health logo on it and the U.S. Department of Justice logo on it that literally the card says, the bearer of this card is allowed not to wear a face mask because they have a medical condition that that keeps them from doing that. There are people literally, using these cards just because they don't want to wear a mask. And at the end of the day, they are putting themselves and others at risk for COVID. And then there's additional scams where we have heard of people calling people, having them answer the phone, even if it says, like, no caller ID available, or if it has, a out-of-state phone number, where people will impersonate contact tracers and ask at least some basic information, but then eventually work their way toward asking for your bank account information or your credit card information to pay for a test. And that is something that, we're never ever going to do. We're never going to ask for your financial information. We're never going to ask for your Social Security number. We're not even going to charge you for testing. It's just important that we arrange to get you tested, pure and simple.
All right. Now let's get to our first caller on the line. Looks like we have Mark waiting with a question. Good afternoon, Mark. Thank you for calling Voice of the Public.
Oh, thank you. About 2 weeks ago, my partner and I went to Memorial Medical Center to get tested for the virus, and we were turned away because they said we were not symptomatic and that the state is too overwhelmed from everybody being tested who wanted it. And, I mean, I've had a few symptoms off and on these past few couple of months, but I didn't appear symptomatic. I didn't feel like it that day. So can I still get tested someplace? The hospital has stopped doing it completely.
Yeah, Mark, thank you very much for that question. The answer is yes. You know, what you can do is pre-register online and be able to get yourself tested at your local public health office. For example, in Las Cruces, they are testing Monday through Fridays here from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. We do test people who are asymptomatic. However, even just a couple of weeks ago, our statewide caseload was higher than it is now. But you know what was happening in the state is that the increased number of cases out there, the lack of masking or distancing in some parts of the state, you know, just leaving home more often is enough to increase your risk for exposure, which then led to a spike in the number of cases, which then also taxes the state's testing capacity ability to be able to get you tested and to get those results back to you in a timely manner. So I'm very sorry that you were turned away from Memorial Medical Center, but they had a very good reason why. And you can, if you're asymptomatic, you can get tested at your local public health office.
We just heard yesterday the governor had an update, and at the beginning of the hour, you heard some comments from the governor about the testing situation. Dr. Torres, what can you say about what the future holds in terms of our ability to meet the need of testing?
Yeah, I think it is a struggle to get reagents or testing equipment needed to do all the tests. But the governor did touch on that we are working towards getting approved to do what they call pooled testing, mm-hmm. which would allow us to test more specimens using fewer reagents. And so that should increase our capacity significantly. I think, you know, in my humble opinion, we have a really hardworking governor that works to really get us the supplies we need, given the large constraints on all of the systems. And so I think, you know, it's interesting to see how there's different shifts in what is needed at different times and how we, you know, first it was that there weren't enough swabs, and then Dr. Grace touched on this yesterday, and then now, you know, they're not able to get the equipment in the lab, or, you know, the disposables in the lab that they use to process the specimen. So I think it's going to continue to be a challenge, and we need to adapt accordingly. But as far as changing the way we're testing, that still remains the same, and we'll just adapt as needed.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Marilyn on the line holding for a question. Good afternoon, Marilyn. Welcome to Voice of the Public.
Hi, thank you. My question is there a sort of best practices standard for how many contact tracers per 100,000 population or some standard like that?
Yeah, the CDC did recommend for the state of New Mexico and our population a number of approximately 640 contact tracers. That is certainly a number that we are working towards, but also I can say that you know, the lower we're able to limit our case numbers, to be able to limit our viral spread, the less need necessarily to have that many people at a given time. That said, though, we still continue to hire and onboard new employees for contact tracing on a weekly basis. There's a lot of training involved from just understanding the software, the questionnaires, and basic communication skills over the phone, because if you're a contact tracer, for example, or a contact investigator, you may be, providing the worst news of the year for people. It's just really important to be able to handle that situation delicately. Currently, in the state, we have between current full-time Department of Health employees temporarily reassigned and temporary employees that are hired exclusively for contact investigation and contact tracing. We have approximately 400 people. That number is still going to continue to trend upward. Even as the case numbers right now are falling, we do recognize, as we get further into the year and we have both flu and COVID to worry about simultaneously, we're probably going to need all of these people on board and reaching out to New Mexicans.
David, two off-air questions. Are you playing on the freeway or sitting at the beach with the ocean waves rolling in? Just an acknowledgement. That's David's air conditioning that we're hearing in the background. And I told you I wouldn't ask you to turn it off because it's 185 degrees, right? So
that's right. I'm also literally in my office building, so I don't even know where the thermostat place is.
They don't let you play with the thermostats.
They do not. No. They put those little lock box on it.
That's right.
Try to knock on the plastic and nothing happens.
All right, 1:22 now at KRWG. This is Voice of the Public. I'm Casey Counts. We are joined this afternoon by New Mexico Department of Health Media Manager and Social Media Manager David Morgan, along with the ABC's coordinator, Dr. Selena Torres, to answer your questions, all COVID-related, back-to-school-related, immunization-related. You mentioned flu season, David, and Dr. Torres, I'm just wondering, at this point, do we have any indication in terms of what we're going to be looking at regarding flu this year? Is the flu vaccine already on the market?
Yes. So for regular, influenza that we see every year, the vaccine is ready. And I believe in New Mexico, we will have it in September. We jokingly talk about this in the Infectious Epi Bureau that, perhaps our social distancing and masking and continual washing hands is going to help us in our flu season. We did have some early predictions from CDC that this may be a rough flu season, and I believe, that they've also said that fall is going to be different and may be bad. So, we really need everybody to get their flu vaccines, and those should start rolling out soon. We are also planning, to be able to administer those in a safe way, while using, PPE as best as we can, so we don't, go through all of our supplies quickly. But we are planning to administer flu vaccine as we have every season. It'll just look a little different this time.
How has the COVID-19 pandemic affected regular immunizations for kids, and are they being required to show proof of those immunizations as the school year gets underway in an online format?
Actually, the answer to that is yes. We do need New Mexicans to be able to assure that they keep their child up with their vaccinations, whether public schools return in a hybrid form or an online-only form because those immunizations, there's a schedule for those things. And there's a reason why there's a schedule for those things, to be able to assure that your child is protected from the very things that these vaccines successfully prevent. These are illnesses, diseases that you don't want to have to be worrying about, especially at a time like this where we are all just hanging in there and holding out until a reliable vaccine that works on more than 90% of the population is available out there. And so to answer your question, how are we doing in terms of immunizations? We're not doing as well as we would like. Immunizations, keeping those on schedule, seem to be down. I think the last number I saw was 20%. So when we do, in addition to doing our COVID testing Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. here in Las Cruces, we are also offering by appointment the opportunity to be able to come inside our public health offices to be able to get your child immunized and keep your child on schedule.
All right. We had a very good question come in from a listener via email before the show today. And here it is. We are a small 55-home homeowners association in Mesilla with a beautiful shared pool, Class B aquatic venue. The order from the New Mexico Environmental Department of June 1st states all public aquatic venues that are not Class A, designed and operated for lap swim or instructional classes, are to continue to remain closed based on the current public health order. She says, or he, obviously, we haven't been able to use the pool all summer. We propose to limit entry to one person or family every 45 minutes. Is there any way we can get an inspection and open the pool for the rest of the summer?
That would actually be something that would need to be addressed by the New Mexico Environment Department, as they are the ones issue orders. They're the ones that inspect public pools across the state. That's a very good question, and certainly swimming is one of the few exceptions to where you don't need to wear a face mask, and I certainly, being stationed here in Las Cruces myself, am incredibly sympathetic for not being able to actually use your pool, where we're having 40 plus days this season of 100 degree plus temperatures. But unfortunately, that is something that is not within the Department of Health's control. That is something you would need to reach out to your local New Mexico Environment Department office here in Las Cruces.
Okay, David, thank you very much. And I don't want to move away from the topic of pool just yet, but in terms of pool testing, I want to get back to that, Dr. Torres, because you mentioned it just briefly that we're kind of on the precipice here of doing pooling testing in New Mexico. Can you explain, exactly how that works, how reliable it is, and how close we are to being able to actually do it, and what it will mean for us?
So the concept behind pool testing is you take a group of specimens, and I believe it's about 5 specimens, and you take a what we call an aliquot, or just a little bit of the specimen from so that you reserve some left in each tube. You take, let's say there's 5, you take a little bit each out of each 5, you put them all together, and then you run the test as you normally would. If the test comes back negative, that means that all of those specimens were negative. If the test comes back positive, then we go back to all 5, and we retest each one individually to see if all 5 were positive or if there was just 1 or 2. So we get a result, an individual result on each 5 if we get a positive result. And so to be able to have the capacity to do that, there is a process where you have to be certified to do it. Maybe David can speak on to where we are as getting certified to be able to do it. But what that would mean is it would, speed up the time to run through the specimens and get a result. And then, as I mentioned, it would, allow us to save on equipment, disposables, and reagents that we use for testing each specimen.
And so would you then call those five people and give them another test to determine which of them were the positive cases?
Well, so we reserve a part of that original specimen, and we leave it in its own tube so it's not contaminated by the others. So we would just go back to that original specimen and take another draw from it and run it individually.
I see. And yes, David, the governor did mention yesterday that we're awaiting federal approval. So do we know exactly what that means?
Unfortunately, what it just means is, we are waiting for federal approval. We don't have a time frame for when we're going to get the thumbs up, but it is something that we are very much looking forward to, because as Dr. Torres said, this is an opportunity for us to really increase our testing capacity and still be able to accurately forecast where we're going, with COVID cases, where the trends are, and it will be very helpful, particularly going into the winter.
I want to encourage you to call with your questions for David Morgan, media manager and social media manager for the New Mexico Department of Health, or Dr. Selena Torres, the ABC's coordinator with the Epidemiology Response Division, 575-646-2212, the number to call. You can also be following us on Facebook Live, and feel free to submit your questions on Facebook. I'm watching it here, so if you have a question and you'd rather just play along on social media, you're more than welcome to. We thank you for listening to Voice of the Public. And I did have another question. It's kind of a recurring question, and I'm not sure at this point really how concrete the answer is, but a listener wants to know how long this virus is on surfaces and dangerous on different surfaces. What can you say to that, Dr. Torres?
I admittedly have not followed the data on this as closely as I did at the beginning. I know that there were different time frames based on the type of surface, porous versus non-porous. I think it's still good practice in general to disinfect all high-touch surfaces, even within a household. Even if it's all the same people within a household, it's just good practice in general. To just disinfect those high-touch surfaces. And then even when you're in your vehicle as well, there's not a lot of evidence, and it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention anymore related to this virus living on surfaces, but the potential does still exist. David, I'm not sure if you have any insight into any new thing about it.
No, I don't. But Dr. Torres, what you say is absolutely right. The research talks about as they experiment with different kinds of surfaces, a granite countertop versus even just a formica countertop, for example. It is just as the doctor said. It should just be one of those things that we do, just like we wash our hands after we use the restroom. Being able to wipe down the surfaces of our home is the best way to be able to assure that we are not giving the virus even a chance to get a toehold, even if it's the little pinky toe. The pinky toe hold in our own households. It's the last thing anybody needs.
All right. Thank you, David. Let's get back to the phone now. Diane holding with a question for you on Voice of the Public. Good afternoon, Diane. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I just wanted to let you know that I actually got my seasonal flu shot last week at Albertson, so we do have it in town already.
All right. Well, thank you very much. All right. Did it hurt? We appreciate
the call. Thank you, Diane.
Yeah, thank you for doing that.
And Diane is absolutely right. Commercial businesses like your local pharmacy at the grocery store and pharmacy chains within our community are already offering the flu shot. Public health across the country doesn't get their vaccines until a little bit later in the year. As Dr. Torres said earlier, we expect to receive or start receiving our vaccine orders in September for when October 1st hits and the official start to flu season begins. But the fact that you already have your flu shot is great. You know, just hearing that makes my day.
And Natalie is also holding with a question. Good afternoon, Natalie. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Great. I did have just a brief question. I don't know if you have addressed it already, but I was wondering, is the state allocating any funds to doing blood testing?
Are you talking about testing for the antibodies?
For testing for the virus as well.
Okay, great question. Thank you. Any allocated funds for blood tests, for antigen or antibody tests?
Currently, what we are doing is we are still doing swab tests, whether it is swabbing inside your nasal cavity or maybe inside your mouth to be able to get the DNA. That is a less expensive route than the blood testing. And so that is what we're currently doing. As we start increasing test capacity even further, there certainly is the possibility that we're going to start also expanding our repertoire on the kinds of testing that we are doing to include that.
And if I understand correctly at this time, if you donate blood, you automatically get an antibody test. Is that correct?
I don't know, just only because I haven't had 2 seconds to practically leave my office in 6 months to know for sure. I believe
yes.
That is the case.
Yes, it is correct. They are doing antibody screening. But I will caution that for an epidemiologic standpoint, a positive antibody test does not... is not definitive for us in our case definition. So we still, if we do receive some results for antibody testing, and what we do with those results is we get in contact with the person and we ask them to go get a confirmatory swab test, because we just cannot be certain one way or the other what the antibody test means. We don't know, if they're still infectious. It's just an indication at this point that the person was exposed, but we have no indication of infectivity, so we need more definitive information to do the public health action. So they are offering it if you donate blood. And, I know that some it is often used as a treatment, so I suspect that's why they're screening, but I couldn't speak for them directly. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
what the motivation is.
Just today, I think, you may not have even seen it yet, but I believe there was some research going on at UNM where they had tried the plasma from folks who had tested positive for the antibodies as a treatment. I think there were only 13 patients involved, but they ended up abandoning that as an effective treatment, saying that they saw no improvement in the patients as a result of using it.
Yeah, so I think there's still a lot of development in that area, and then how we're going to interpret those results we're still working through it. But but that doesn't negate that you should still donate blood. It's important.
Oh, for sure. 139 and 575-646-2212, the number to call if you'd like to ask a question this afternoon on Voice of the Public. We're glad you're here, and we still have so much territory to cover. Right now, I want to move over to back to school. And specifically, first, university campuses. Here at New Mexico State University, we had students that out-of-state students that came in early to be able to do that two-week quarantine, and they're doing some testing, but they're not doing testing for all of the students that will return to campus. What can we expect in terms of our college campuses moving forward?
Any time that you get a group of people together in one place, especially a confined space like, say, a classroom, a dormitory, a cafeteria, you are running the risk of the increased potential of spread of COVID-19. So we recognize that, and you know, that's why you know, no face-to-face teaching is scheduled to begin in this state until after Labor Day. As we get more data, as we continue to try to limit our, the people of New Mexico's venturing out into public, because it's, you know, every time we go out in public, we are again increasing our risk. So we are looking at all of those issues to be able to make an informed decision as to how we're going to proceed with the school year moving forward after Labor Day weekend. But also we are tracking what is happening in other states where they have opened their schools and their college campuses and their public schools. And those states are already starting to see a new spike in the number of cases on their campuses. So seeing what other states are going through versus what we are preparing for, what we are planning to do, and what the case levels for New Mexico are trending towards as we get past the Labor Day holiday. All of that is really going to be our guide as to what we definitively do.
Well, speaking of the Labor Day holiday, that's one of those weekends that, you know, over the course of the summer, when we've had our holiday weekends, we tend to have seen some spikes after that. And do we wait for a couple of weeks to determine how we did on the Labor Day weekend before making a decision?
Well, you know, regardless, we need to definitely be we can't celebrate Labor Day this year the way we have always celebrated it. This is not the time to be road tripping. This isn't the time for a vacation. This isn't the time for a large family cookout. It's not the time for parties. This is the time where we really just, for better and for worse, we need to shelter in place as best as humanly possible. And then, of course, mask up and maintain distance from strangers for those times that we do have to venture out. Time will tell, really, and people's behavior will tell the tale as to how the upcoming Labor Day weekend will affect caseloads in our state.
Now, I want to address when we talk about masks. Just yesterday, Dr. David Scrace had some new information to share with us on what type of mask or face covering we should depend on and which ones we should avoid. I guess no more bandanas, huh?
Bandanas just allow for the possibility that when we talk sometimes, there's that little spittle that can come out. Bandanas, allow for the better chance of that leaking out there. What we're trying to do, though, is be able to, make sure that, we have masks that properly filter the droplets, the saliva, the spittle, for lack of a better word, that comes out of our mouths sometimes when we're talking. And so bandanas don't really work there. We are, talking about, really the kind of surgical mask the knitted mask, those kinds of more traditional face masking is more effective for sure.
I guess what we're looking at is something that covers, that, you know, kind of snugly covers the bottom of the chin as well as the top of the nose, right?
That is right.
Yeah.
That is right.
And I'll just add that it also has to do with the fabric's ability to not allow particles to go through. So the information that Dr. Scrace was providing was based on a study where they actually used like a sophisticated system where they had a laser that could track what was able to get through the barrier. And for bandanas, you know, like 40% of the particles were still able to go through, and that's why, or the 0.55 droplets were still able to get through, and that's why it's lower on the list of the most effective things. But I think another point to make is that, you know, distancing and washing hands and masks are all great in combination, and that's what gives us the best chance, you know, of stopping the spread. So it's good to use all of the tools that we know work. I think if we just all distance, then it wouldn't be as effective as distancing and masking and washing hands as much as possible. So I think we need to keep in mind that, you know, all of these tools can be used together, and that gives us our best chance.
I want to talk a little bit about the rapid response going on around the state. It looks like at this point our area is getting more of that than other areas in the state. Tell us what's going on.
So when we're talking about rapid response, we're talking about something that happens in collaboration with the Department of Health and the New Mexico Environment Department and even other agencies. So, you know, what we're talking about with rapid response, we're talking about being able to reach out to certain businesses, certain public locations to be able to, see where necessary. Is it to quarantine and test? Is it situations, every situation has the potential to be different as to whether we're quarantining and testing some employees or all employees. It really does depend on the situation. Our rapid responses also work with the businesses to commit to retesting affected employees and being able to disinfect the workplace and certainly be able to implement a safety plan that goes along with the COVID safe practice requirements to be able to basically keep everything wiped down to try to minimize germs to, again, minimize spread.
575-646-2212, the number to call. We don't have that much time left. So if you have a question, it's important that you call now so you can get your question in here before we do run out of time. The New Mexico Department of Health spokesman David Morgan on the line, as well as Dr. Selena Torres, the ABC's coordinator with the Epidemiology Response Division. One of the most heartbreaking things about this last few months for so many people is that they have loved ones in assisted living facilities, and they have gone so many months being isolated, not being able to see their loved ones. What is the status now for nursing home visitation?
So for nursing home visitation, we have to have a county where the totals of positive cases is at a lower threshold in order to be able to allow that ability to visit your loved ones. Last I looked at Doñana County, we still had more spread than other counties, so our counties aren't able to allow visitation for our loved ones at nursing homes or long-term care facilities. This is one of the most emotionally difficult subjects because the Department of Health is in the business of trying to preserve life And for that, you know, we have, you know, closed nursing homes and long-term care facilities from visitors on the outside in order to have the best chance of being able to protect the health of those residents. They are our most vulnerable population. I think 40 somewhere along the lines of 40% of the initial deaths that occurred at the start of this pandemic came from nursing homes and long-term care facilities. So it's just incredibly high risk for any one of us to go visit our loved one at a nursing facility. And at the same time, the emotional impact, the psychological impact that happens on our loved ones in those facilities, and really, you know, for ourselves as well, has been great. This is a very difficult situation, the counties where visitation is now being allowed, like I said, they have a lower rate of viral spread, but the ability to visit under those conditions is also less than ideal as well.
I'm not sure which of you could answer this question, but there's something that pops up from time to time in different places, and I'm not sure if it's the case in New Mexico, where assisted living facilities will actually have an area or maybe a wing where they would actually take patients who, say, aren't sick enough to be in the hospital, but they would be treated at some area in the assisted living facility. Do you know if that's the case in our state?
In our particular case, we actually have one facility that stepped up and is a COVID-only facility. So for folks that still require some acute care, but don't have to stay at the hospital, can go to this facility. The facility is, unfortunately located in Albuquerque, so that is, again, taking a loved one potentially further away from you than they were, even if they were in the local facility. However, Canyon Transitional has really done a very good job of being able to assure that spread of the virus is as minimal as humanly possible, and there is a lot of success in which people are able to be treated in that facility, and then ultimately be released to be able to either return to their families or return to the facilities they resided at.
All right. Janet has a question, off-air question from Janet. How do the numbers in Doñana County compare to the rest of New Mexico? Dr. Torres, can you take this one?
Yes. So Doñana County does have a higher positivity rate than the rest of the, it has the highest positivity rate than all the other counties in the region, in the Southwest region. So I just pulled the numbers this morning, and so 9%, that means that of all the testing done in Doñana County, 9% of those cases are positive this week. If we compare that to the Southwest region, it's at 6.7. And then if we compare that to the state, we were, I believe, at about 3% mm-hmm. or a little bit lower. So it is significantly higher. Doñana County has also seen the highest number of cases this week among the counties in the Southwest region. So there is, there is that increase that is occurring in that specific in Doñana.
Is there a reason for that we can point to at this point?
The increase in case counts that we've been seeing tend to trend towards workplace clusters. I will also say that we do see a good amount of cases that have a connection to Texas. you know, because it's of the proximity, obviously. And then also there's a good amount of people that work in New Mexico, or I'm sorry, live in New Mexico but work in Texas, and then vice versa. So there is a good amount of migration, and it makes sense to me that Doña Ana County would be affected by that movement of people for work and other reasons. So that seems to be the increase, you know, what's causing some of the increase. There's also, you know, been an increase in the younger age groups becoming positive, and of course that could also have to do with work, and then, you know, being more mobile than let's say our older folks that were affected in the early parts of the pandemic.
So is that what we would expect to see, is that early on we would see that oldest, most vulnerable portion of the population, and then as we close things down and then reopen things, it would be the younger side of the population that would become infected? Is that pretty typical?
Well, I think nothing is typical about this pandemic, yeah. but I will say that, you know, it does trend with the types of jobs that require you to not, or that do not allow you to work from home, are usually those done by our younger workforce. So it does trend in that way. You know, unfortunately, a lot of younger people do live in households with older, more vulnerable, individuals. So we could potentially start to see an increase in those older individuals if, you know, our numbers aren't going down quick enough.
All right. And in the last few minutes, 575-646-2212, the number to call. This is Voice of the Public on KRWG. Casey Counts here, along with David Morgan, spokesman for the New Mexico Department of Health, and Dr. Selena Torres, ABC's coordinator with the Epidemiology Response Division. Now, just because the pandemic is going on doesn't mean we can ignore other concerns that are happening from a public health perspective. It's West Nile season. Do we have you know, any concerns to look at regarding West Nile? What are the numbers like so far? Any cases yet?
I am unaware of any cases. Dr. Torres, I'm sorry, I think I tripped over you.
No, I was actually going to say, you know, I've got COVID on the brain, and I don't know that I have a grasp of that. I know that we have had a West Nile case this year, but I couldn't tell you which county it was. I can provide that, and maybe you can put that on your on the Facebook page so individuals can be you know, aware of it.
Sure.
Of course, we're always worried about mosquito-borne illnesses. So we need to still use our same precautions that we always do, you know, avoid having standing water in your yard, use insect repellent as much as possible. I think, you know, you bring up a good point in that all of this, everything else is still happening, and then COVID is on top of that. So there's a lot of other public health concerns that we still deal with on a daily basis. You know, for a while, we didn't hear about them, and I think that's when we were in lockdown and everybody was, you know, people weren't getting foodborne illness because they weren't going out to eat and they were preparing things at home. But as we open up more and more, the things that, you know, consumed our days as public health professionals are coming back slowly. And that's just another reason why we need to be on top of our preventive measures, like as David mentioned, the, you know, vaccinating, keeping up to date with our vaccines and our children. It would be really unfortunate if we were got to the point where we could open our schools and then we ended up with a measles outbreak in a school. So we want to be prepared as possible, you know, having to work within the constraints of our system because of COVID, but we still can do as much public health as possible.
We had a plague death in our state. It's not, we have a case or two maybe every year. And I think that catches people by surprise when they hear the word plague. Why don't you tell us what we need to know about that?
Right. So for plague, we did have a plague death. And, you know, we do have a few cases here and there, not very often. And it's an unfortunate situation. It seems like, you know, I think we were on a call with some other, with colleagues for a different reason, and they said, wait, what? A plague? What? This is, like, are we going backwards in time? So, yeah, I mean, we just need to be aware that, you know, we still need to have proper flea control for our animals, and that is a possibility in New Mexico. It is endemic here, so we need to be cautious about that. If your animal becomes sick, or if you become sick with, fever unexpectedly, then we definitely want you to be evaluated by a healthcare professional. Obviously, it could be COVID, but it could be something else.
Fleas, you said?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's the culprit, the flea.
Fleas are one of the culprits. It can also be sick or dead rodents or rabbits. It can, even be their nests or burrows, where there is the ability to be able to pick up the plague, and then in turn, have your pet transmit it to you. Plague cases aren't very common in the United States, but they do happen in New Mexico. A handful out of the year at most, and they usually occur in the northern part of the state. But even here in the southwest part of the state, where the vast majority of the southwestern part of New Mexico is rural or small communities,
yes.
Potential still exists.
It can happen. Well, we are out of time once again. Dr. Selena Torres, David Morgan from the Department of Health, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
And Leora Zeitlin is coming up next, Intermezzo by Request.